Thursday edition. Thanks very much for tuning in. I can't wait to talk to Ian Scher from CNET because the tech world is involved in so many issues this week. Amazon with their big announcement that they're going to build a second headquarters in H2, I forget what they call it, but something clever like that. Anyway, 50,000 workers, $5 billion. So I'll talk to him about that, about Facebook and the Russian meddling, and also about DACA. You know, the tech world, very influential there. President Trump working with the Democrats, apparently now on a debt limit. We just finished up recording The Mincing Rascals. I don't know if you subscribe to that podcast, but John Williams plays part of it on his Saturday show. And you can subscribe. Eric Zorn, John Williams, and I this week talking about political issues. And one of the things Zorn suggested was that we get rid of the debt limit altogether because nothing good ever comes from it, you know, being held hostage, government shutdowns and all of that. And lo and behold, I walk out of the recording there and come down to do this show, and I see the Washington Post reporting that the president and Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, are going to push for that, to get rid of it altogether. I don't know how successful they'll be, but maybe we'll talk to Elise Glink about that coming up. Right now, you know, yesterday we had on Representative of Matter. We talked to 1871. All of these different organizations to help young businesses get started, to grow and to thrive. Well, one of them, SCORE, has been around for 53 years. The event chairman for SCORE Chicago is on a phone line now to talk a little bit about that. Don Pollack, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you, and for the wonderful opportunity to talk about SCORE.
Well, I'm glad you're here because, you know, we talk sometimes about the bright, shiny new objects and do that to do maybe a disservice to those groups that have been around a little bit longer. Tell me about SCORE.
Well, SCORE, as you said, is a 53-year-old national nonprofit resource partner of the Small Business Administration that utilizes the volunteer services and business expertise of current and former business owners and executives, and we provide free, unlimited, and confidential mentoring, free and low-cost business workshops, and free consulting to entrepreneurs starting and operating small businesses.
What does it mean to be a partner of the SBA?
We partner with them in terms of providing these resources for people starting and operating small businesses. So we receive some of our funds from them, although the majority are raised from sponsors, foundations, etc. So we definitely partner with the SBA. We do not originate loans for businesses, but we prepare them to approach banks to obtain SBA loans.
All right, so let's say I'm a guy with a business idea and I need some help. I need some mentoring or just someone to bounce ideas off of. That's where we find SCORE? That's where I go to SCORE?
Absolutely. We have a website that's www.chicago.score.org where they can apply for mentoring sessions. They can also call our office and talk to Margie at 312-353-7724. And we are available. There are 120 volunteers in the Chicago chapter. There are 300 chapters throughout the country, over 11,000 total volunteers. Our 120 volunteers mentor from 20 sites in Chicago throughout the suburbs. We provide 250 workshops a year, provide over 6,000 services, 20 consulting projects, over 24,000 hours.
Well, Dan, so here's my thing, though. So, you know, we talk about these incubators and all of that, and obviously SCORE has been around longer than most of the incubators, as I said, the bright, shiny new objects. I'm wondering, you know, because when I talk to younger people who are running businesses or who cover business, I try to impress upon them how remarkable the climate has changed in the last 10, 15, or 20 years, where, you know, it used to be so much more difficult to sort of get things going. There's so many more doors to be opened, easier to open doors now than it would have been back then. So tell me, as a guy who's been mentoring businesses, how it's changed from, I mean, let's go back to 2000 or 2008 just till today.
Well, obviously, with the development of the internet, the change has been tremendous. the social media effect on marketing and sales. Many businesses today are internet-based, as opposed to going back to 2000 when you had perhaps more manufacturing startups.
Right.
And we have a continuing education process with our mentors to keep us current with all the developments that have taken place, especially the digital type of...
You know, you used to have to go knock on doors and do face-to-face meetings and all of that. I mean, one of my little side jobs was I used to interview authors for BarnesandNoble.com, and it was in the beginning of podcasting, and I think I did it from like 2004 to maybe 2008 or 7 or something like that. And I worked for them for 2 years before I actually even met anyone at Barnes & Noble. I'd only had one phone conversation with them. The whole interaction, I mean, everything we did was via email and over the internet. The idea of human interaction has just changed dramatically.
It has, but our mentoring, for the most part, is done person to person, even though we have email mentoring available and do things like Skype and FaceTime. You can't discount the importance of meeting face to face with someone. And I think today, because people have become so dependent upon emailing and the internet for communicating,
right,
those who are still effective at the person to person level are really achieving things because of the fact that the personal aspect has been so removed.
If that's in your skill set, you're going to stand out because, for me, it's much easier to send back. You know, I think sometimes you lose communication in email, but it's also easier. There's less risk in writing something sometimes than to go face-to-face and have a conversation.
That's true, and it's much easier to get to know someone. And a lot of what we do in the initial mentoring sessions is really an understanding of who we're dealing with, what their goals are, and how we can help them in the sessions that follow the first one, because we understand seeing somebody one time is really not going to be successful.
And I know it's a ways off, but you've got an event coming up in February. Tell me real quickly about that.
We do. It's at Lowe's Chicago Hotel. It's our first major small business forum. It's going to feature 3 one-hour sessions, presentations, lunch, networking, a keynote speaker. We're very excited about it. We're hoping to have 400 small business owners, and we'll do a lot of PR for it, social media, etc. We have a website that's www.scorebusinessforum.org, and we're very excited about it.
Dan Pollack, the event chairman for SCORE Chicago. Great to talk to you. I'm glad to get the introduction.
Thank you very much.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger's in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill Geiger are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. And, it's good to see you today, Bill, more than most days. I know you got a lot on your mind.
Good to see you, sir.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And, you know, we were talking off the air about Hurricane Irma, and you and I talk off the air about the fact that you have a spot down there.
We have a home between Boca and Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it looks like that could be in the path.
Well, it does, but I'll tell you something. We constructed our home a little bit less than 3 years ago. It's to hurricane code. We have hurricane insurance on top of it. And our property manager brought the pool furniture into the garage last night.
Right.
So we're prepared for it. And I really am not that worried about anything happening.
You're not worried?
No, I'm not. Because we've done everything we can. We're prepared well as possible.
And what a segue that would be to finances and being prepared for retirement.
Well, it is. There's a parallel there. If you're in your late 50s to early 60s, your portfolio really shouldn't look like a 30-year-old's. When the next financial hurricane comes, and we never know when that's going to be, the point is you need to be prepared. You need to transition from a 30-year-old's portfolio to a pre-retirement portfolio. Steve, if you think about it, most people in their late 50s, early 60s have more money than they've ever had before.
Okay.
And the last thing they need at that stage of their life is a big loss. So if you're in that time frame, you don't know when the next financial downturn's coming, but what you want to do is you want to make your portfolio as bulletproof as humanly possible. That's what we did with our house.
It's kind of an interesting thing, and not to continue to torture the parallel, but you know, there are a lot of people trying to prepare right now for Hurricane Irma.
Right.
And there might have been some things, certainly not everything, but some things that they might have been able to do a year or two ago.
I saw in the news people fighting in stores over gas cans. They've run out of gasoline in gas stations. On the other hand, I have a very good friend in Florida who had a generator installed at his house. He had hurricane shutters installed at his house, and all of his gas cans have been full for a month.
Right.
So he's ready. You know, he's created as bulletproof as possible situation for himself.
But I hope he's not staying, Bill. Is he getting out of there?
No, he's actually staying.
Oh, see. Okay, so you can be prepared and not be smart.
Well, that could be too.
Get him on the phone. Come on, let's get him out of there. Okay, so to take that then, so what should people be doing now with their income if they're 55 to 60?
Well, if you're late 50s, early 60s, you really need to sit down and understand just how much risk you have in your portfolio. That's critical, and Steve, most people don't have a clue.
I was going to say, how do you figure out the risk? I mean, there are like online formulas and things like that.
We have a tool that we use in the office. It's an institutional version of Morningstar.
So here, let me do it this way, because you know when people fill out those and you try to figure out your risk.
Yeah.
When you get to be a certain age, when you need to protect, you might not be the best one to figure out what your risk is, what your risk tolerance is.
No, you're not. And you take these quizzes online, and it tells you what risk category you're
right.
in. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about your current portfolio. We take every account and every position that a client has, put it into Morningstar, and they create a three-page report that allows us to talk very intelligently about risk. I'll give you an example. Had a couple come in last week.
Mm-hmm.
Told me they were moderate investors. We ran them through this analysis. The next 2008 comes along, they're going to lose 60% of their portfolio. And they're 60 years old.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
So they weren't nearly
as moderate. That will change their whole
life. They weren't as moderate as they thought.
No, they weren't anywhere close to what they thought. And that's kind of sort of typical when we do this analysis. Listen, I know you're going to talk about this in a moment. We're going to do something special. The next five people who call in who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, we'll run the test I was just telling you about, the Morningstar mm-hmm. analysis. We'll also sit down with them personally and help them put together a full-blown financial plan, and we're going to do it on a complimentary basis.
How hard is it to gather the data or get what you need for that?
Well, you just bring your statements.
Right.
That's it.
And that's all you need.
You bring your statements, you come in, we'll do all the rest of the work.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks for coming by today. I'll be thinking of you. Let me know how everything goes.
Will do.
I know you got a great look on your face. I hope that I hope reality matches it up.
It will.
Thanks very much for tuning in. I'm going to take, I won't be in tomorrow, right? Today's Thursday. Suzanne Mushin will be filling in tomorrow. So thanks to her in advance. I appreciate that. Ian Schur is on a phone line. He joins us on most Thursdays from CNET. He's the executive editor. So really one of the highest ranking employees of CNET. And so I'm thrilled that he takes the time to talk to me from time to time. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, I feel like you're overselling who I am.
No, how could I do that? That's not possible. Look, while Kim was doing the headlines, the New York Times just bulletined a story, and I'll just read you the headline. Thousands of fake Facebook and Twitter accounts that were used to influence the 2016 election have something in common, Russian fingerprints. So they have done this deep dive with a cybersecurity company and have come out with an extensive report on that today that I'm sure we'll be digesting through the rest of the week. But, you know, here we are the day after Facebook. I don't know if I want to use the word admitted. Admitted might be a little unfair to Facebook, but after
disclosed
that they took at least $100,000 in payments for ads that were fake news purveyors from Russia, essentially, right?
Yes, and it's a pretty troublesome thing to see. You know, one of the struggles I think that the tech industry has, and particularly with internet companies, is that they have so many people advertising on their sites so often and from so many different places that it's very hard to keep control and to stop people from doing bad or illegal things. And Facebook and Google have dealt with this quite a bit. You know, you've had on Facebook they have rules against, for example, selling drug paraphernalia and all sorts of stuff like that. And the Wall Street Journal did an investigation a few years ago and found that stuff like, you know, gun holsters were being sold to teenagers in inner cities, right? And were being shown in ads to them. And so there's a lot of troubles that come with the way that advertising is done on the web. And it allows for something like this, where the Russians come in, and at least people who are, you know, believed to be connected to the Russian government come in, are able to do things that are considered to be impacting our election by geo-targeting ads and basically trying to get people riled up about issues and spreading false news about it.
And the $100,000 are what Facebook has disclosed. They say they are continuing to look, right? There's no indication that this is all that there was.
No, there's not any indication. And if I was a betting man, I'd say there's probably going to be more that's found. If for no other reason than every other time Facebook has disclosed something embarrassing, it's turned out to be bigger than they originally thought.
And so what were these guys, what were these fake news people doing? They weren't really saying vote for Hillary Clinton or vote for Donald Trump or vote for whomever, right? They were kind of on the fringe of wedge issues and trying to drive people that way.
Yes. And what they were basically doing is trying to inflame people's sensibilities around stuff like racial issues, gay rights, and stuff like that. And so, you know, one of the things that we've been learning as we've been looking back at the last year is that this election very much was about people's aggrieved sensibilities and this kind of argument about where our culture is going. And so by posting about these types of things, you're inflaming that conversation. And especially if those things are fake, it causes even more trouble, right? I mean, beyond all that.
Exactly, if it's made up. Let me give you a real-world example. And, you know, this is something that happened. I don't care how you feel about it one way or another. That's not my point. But I think it was in 2004 for the George Bush reelection campaign. Karl Rove, the quote-unquote architect, you know, wanted to figure out an issue like this to inflame people or to energize people, depending on how you felt. And so they worked to get a number of anti or pro-gay marriage referenda on state ballots. The idea was people were going to go out and vote for that because they felt strongly for it or against it. And that's what helped George Bush win. That's kind of what we're talking about here, right? Not a direct candidate, but an issue that might piss people off about something and get them to vote one way or another.
Yeah. And look, I mean, this is something that has been a typical thing that, you know, has been done in elections for a long time. I mean, if you look at, you could go back to the Clinton campaign, right? And the famous quote that came out of one of his strategists says, the economy, stupid, right?
Right.
There's always an issue that they raise. And yes, in the last 10, 15 years, social issues have become a key part of the way that elections have been run. And, you know, this is, now we're just seeing it more and more happen on the internet. And what's troubling here, right, and bringing it back to Facebook, is that instead of a architect for a presidential campaign bringing up issues that might be important to voters or an issue that the candidate wants to get on board with, this is a foreign government trying to impact our election.
A foreign government that doesn't like us. It's an adversary.
Right. Yeah, well,
that's an excellent point.
Right? Yeah.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. It's not an American doing it. Okay, so Zuckerberg said right after the election, you know, that he thought it was kind of crazy that Facebook might have influenced the election one way or another. Does he have to reassess that now?
You know, I think that he has been reassessing it since November. And I think part of the reassessment, frankly, has been about his own politics as well, right? Originally, Mark Zuckerberg looked at Facebook as this utopia where you could, you know, you had free speech around the world. You had the ability to basically get people to really push the boundaries. And you had stuff like the Arab Spring and all these other things that happened because of Facebook and Twitter. And it was really, you know, he saw this as this great place. And so people sharing ideas, people, all that stuff, he thought, you know, there's no way that it could be causing an election to be affected. And as news stories came out, these false news stories like the Pope endorsing Donald Trump, which wasn't real,
right,
and stuff like that, it actually was impacting the election more than I think he realized. And, you know, that there was that whole series of stories by the Macedonian teenagers that were all fake, including the Pizzagate and all this other stuff. And it just, I think he's really come to terms now with the fact that Facebook has a lot more power than he thought, and people are abusing it in ways that he never imagined.
I will also say this, you know, in the legitimate news media has come under fire, and you can feel however you want about it. But I think people who fall for this stuff bear a little responsibility, too. And I hope that if they're listening here, you will at least run it through a little thicker filter. Every time you see something, look who's writing it, look who's behind it, and make sure there's something legitimate, someone you know or trust to do that. Because you know what? If you fall for stuff that is clearly untrue, you bear a little responsibility as well. Okay.
Absolutely.
That's mine. Oh, hey, Jeff Bezos is going to be on the show in about 10 minutes, and he's going to announce that they're moving to Chicago.
Well, there you go. You know, there's definitely all this talk about Amazon looking at a second headquarters. And, you know, a lot of people, it's really fascinating how much Amazon has grown and how powerful it has become. I mean, you look at all the different industries it's in. It is in movies, it's in music, it's in books, obviously, it's in just about Whole Foods. And so it's really interesting to see how far this company has gone, and them announcing the second headquarters that they're planning is really, I think, just it's a moment, right? It's kind of the same thing as Apple when in 2011 they announced their new campus that looked like a spaceship. You know, it's a moment where they're really saying we are at the top of our game and then some, and we think we're going to go further. Interesting to see.
Is the second headquarters, that just sounds incredibly uncommon for me. I mean, people will have a headquarters somewhere and then have branch offices or things like that, but an altogether declare something a second headquarters seems odd.
Yeah, I think it's just an issue of semantics. Yeah. Okay. I mean, really, you know, the thing is that they're going to have a large number of people in this new building, wherever it is. And, you know, they're going to be essentially probably making sure that major decisions are coming out of it as well. And so as a result, I think that's why they're calling it that. But you could call it whatever you want, right? I mean, you know, the Air Force One isn't Air Force One unless the president's on it. Otherwise, it's just another plane.
I'm going to call it a cash cow. That's what I'm going to call it, Ian.
There you go.
John Pletz writes for Crane Chicago Business, and he had a story out pretty quickly saying that Mayor Emanuel had already been on the phone with Jeff Bezos at Amazon talking about the potential here. They've got a number of developments here. Now, I know they've got a number of developments all over the country, but, boy, it would be nice to see that mega power come to the city of Chicago.
Well, in Chicago also, I mean, you think about the commodities trading that happens there and just the amount of goods that flow through that city, and it totally makes sense to do that. But I'm sure that, you know, there are a lot of things that they're considering. One of the other things Amazon is that it's a tech company that's not in Silicon Valley. They're in Seattle. So that may be another thing that also weighs on them. But, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff. Land being costly is one thing they have to think about. Where do they want their employees to be? Where do the employees, you know, where will the employee pool be coming from? All these things come into consideration on top of whatever benefits they might get from the state and the city.
That is Ian Schur, the executive editor at CNET. And good golly, he lived up to his billing. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Take care.
Elise Glink is in the studio. Elise Glink, the publisher of ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. And we're just starting to talk about that. An HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress and then dial it down. Find more at bestmoneymoves.com and get there quickly before all the awards start piling up, right?
We're hoping. We've got our fingers crossed.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you just got named a semifinalist for a pretty big award, right?
It is. HR Tech, which looks at all the technology in the HR space, they do something called the Awesome New Technology of the Year, and we've made it to the semifinalist round. So there were over 150 entrants, and we're in the top eight.
And give me a quick sell. What is Best Money Moves?
So Best Money Moves falls in the financial wellness space. And what we do is we have a stressometer, trademarked now, thank you to my attorneys.
Really? That wasn't trademarked before?
No.
Wow.
No. So we have a stressometer. And what people do is they measure their stress in 15 categories. And then we help them dial down what's causing the financial stress by zeroing in on the actual problem and then sending them relevant information, tools, you know, help, all the rest. And then if they really need more personalized help, we have live money coaches who can help them with their debt budget, credit, housing, and even bankruptcy
issues. Bestmoneymoves.com. And this is done more through an employer than individual.
Right. It's not it's not B2C at the moment, although we hope by next year, we're going to, the beginning of 2018, we're going to offer a version through thinklink.com. Anybody who goes there will be able to sign up. But right now, we have employers around the country, particularly in Chicago and Atlanta and in Denver, and soon San Francisco, New York, all of whom who have signed up and are giving it to their employees.
That's exciting. Good for you.
Thank you.
So, you know, right before I do the shows on Thursdays, I do the 11 o'clock news, go to another studio. We record the Mincing Rascals podcast. And then I run down here and do this. And during the Mincing Rascals, we were talking today about President Trump sort of cozying up to the Democratic leaders for a 3-month debt ceiling extension. And Eric Zorn, who's on the one of the Rascals, said at the time, like, well, you know, they should just get rid of it altogether because it's sort of, it always gets extended. And all it does is sort of create havoc, create crises that don't need to be. And I came downstairs, plugged in my computer or powered it up and see a report that President Trump and Chuck Schumer, the ranking Democrat, are actually working on something just like that to get rid of the debt ceiling altogether. I don't know if that's a good idea for the country or a bad idea. I hate the drama. You know the money.
Right. I can't believe that the Republicans who are in charge in both houses would ever let this pass, because they're all about, particularly their conservative wing, not, you know, shrinking government, not having this, you know, sort of blank checkbook
expand
government.
But it is true, isn't it? I mean, it's never been not extended. There's
it's always been extended. But remember,
it's always like you eat these green beans or you're going straight to your room, and then you never eat the green beans and you never have to go to your room.
We never had a fight over it. I mean, for decades, this just sort of happened and grew and shrunk under some Democratic presidents. We did have a shrinking of the deficit and the amount that we spend. We did have a budget surplus at one point in time. But this idea that, you know, why, you have to think to yourself, why would Trump, who's the master at just sort of flipping with the wind, why would he suddenly be for a blank checkbook if he's such a checkbook conservative?
Right.
And I think the answer has got to be that he is thinking that if he has a blank checkbook, he can push through the price of the wall without fighting the Republicans.
Oh, so you think he's going to get that in exchange?
I think that he's thinking that he wants a wall, and it's like outrageously expensive, and his own party doesn't want to pay for it.
Oh,
so how is he going to get it paid for?
Yeah, it's like, oh, don't worry about the cost, because it's unlimited now.
It's unlimited. We don't have to fight anybody for it.
All right, so there's that. We'll see. We both kind of agree it's not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
In fact, already 150 conservatives have sent a letter to the speaker saying they don't like the 30 or the 90 day debt limit extension. So
sure. Why would they like that? That's Christmas. That's a nightmare for Christmas.
So probably a year ago or so, when we started talking about the Fed increasing interest rates,
mm-hmm.
people were talking about, is this the time to buy a house? Mortgage rates are going to go up. They're going to go up. Mortgage rates aren't really going up.
Going down.
What's that about?
So this is really interesting. The Fed came out the other day and said we were wrong about inflation. It didn't get a lot of news because, hello, we have two hurricanes and the president and President Hurricane and whatever. But it didn't get a lot of news. But one of the Fed Fed governors came out and said, it looks like we might have been wrong about target inflation. And so what's been happening with inflation is, and you'll remember this from 10 years ago when we had the huge crises, everybody, all the Republicans were out there saying we're going to have hyperinflation. And they were projecting 11%. The return to where we were in the gas and oil crisis in the early 80s, we were going to see 10, 11, 12, 15% hyperinflation. Right now, we're looking at maybe 1.5% inflation.
Right.
And so the Fed finally has been trying to keep the lid on inflation. And yet we don't have any. And so I think that the bond market's reflecting this.
So go buy a house if you can find one for sale.
Refi, because rates really went down. Refi.
All right. Elise Glink, thanks for coming by.
It's a pleasure.
When do we find out about the Tech Awards?
I will let you know when everybody can go and vote, because it's a popularity contest.
Oh, we're all over that in Chicago.